This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Avocados from South America, apples from New Zealand instead of the next valley, industrially grown carrots with no taste, no vitamins, but a microscopic coating of carcinogenic pesticides. Meanwhile, we're paving over the nearby farms, leaving our cities utterly dependent on global corporations, on cruelty to workers and animals, on oil and daily long-distance trucking and airplanes. If something breaks down or just runs down into collapse, your city can go into starvation in a single week. And the great food system keeps heating the planet, threatening all agriculture. Against all that is a rising tide of support for local food producers. It is a food revolution, and I don't use that word lightly. You will hear two voices of sanity and, yes, of hope, and I hardly ever use that word. The local food movement started with a book, The 100-Mile Diet, by Alyssa Smith and James McKinnon. In Vancouver, Canada, this couple went a year eating only locally produced food. It wasn't easy then. It is a little easier now in many North American cities, as the idea of sustainable cities catches on. 5 years beyond the success of their first book, Smith and McKinnon give us a rapid-fire tour of great ideas, the 10 best local food projects in the United States and Canada. With a culture check against a tiny village in northern Spain, are the Europeans really better with their food? You'll be surprised as local food networks spring up in Toronto, New York, Michigan, and Los Angeles. This talk was recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock at the Museum of Vancouver in Canada on November 25, 2010. The museum was one of the sponsors, along with the Tai'i magazine and the Tides Foundation, who funded a series of 10 talks on transition and localization. Good on them. We'll tune in just after the introduction by David Beers, the editor of the Tai'i, close friend, and a local food activist at the beginning of this localization of food.
I want to start, I guess, by going back about 3 years to when the 100-Mile Diet was published. One of the first things we discovered after the book came out was that if you write a book about food, suddenly everybody wants to share their food with you. That's, you know, one of the great benefits of food writing. And so all of a sudden we were getting these invitations. We'd spent this year, you know, trying to get all of our food as close to our house as possible. And all of a sudden we were being asked to go all over the continent, basically to sit down and eat dinner with people. It was kind of the 10,000-mile diet all of a sudden. And we literally were invited from the Yukon to Miami and from New Brunswick to San Francisco and all kinds of points in between. And it's been, you know, really a wonderful adventure, and we've eaten a lot of really good food. One of my favorite meals actually was here in BC in the town of Smithers in northern BC. And the reason that one's so memorable is that after the book came out, reporters were often coming to us and saying, well, of course you can eat locally in a place like Vancouver, but this would never be possible somewhere like northern British Columbia. And then we got this invitation to a local meal in Smithers, 100% local meal, and it was a 12-course meal. So after that, the reporters would come and say, well, you could never do this in northern British Columbia, and we'd be able to say, well, yeah, you just have to survive on those 12-course dinners. One thing we really noticed, though, as we traveled to all these places was that if you went from place to place and you bought your food at the supermarket, then you'd pretty much get the same thing wherever you went. It didn't change that much from Miami to the Yukon if you go to the Safeway. But if you went from place to place and you went to the farmer's market, then there could be a huge difference in what people were eating, even within, you know, 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers. So what we wanted to share today is not, you know, not really a point-by-point comparison of Vancouver, you know, how it's worse or better than this place or that place, but as Dave was saying, sort of 10 projects and places that we think point to some of the new directions that local eating might be going, because the local food movement is really, it's really brand new. It's just out of its diapers. If you think about organic food, I mean, organics have now changed the way people eat in North America across the board. But that didn't happen for about, you know, 20 or 25 years after organics hit the mainstream. So local food's taking off right now, but there's a lot of opportunities to take it to a deeper place. And just to give you an example of the kinds of things that have, you know, that we get excited about, I'm actually going to start right here in Vancouver. So last year, we got all of our vegetables from spring through fall from one farmer. That's Ward Toulon, who some of you might know. He might even be here. I don't know. And you might know him better by his kind of nom de jardin, I guess, which is City Farm Boy. Yeah, City Farm Boy, in case you aren't familiar with it, is Ward is a farmer in the city. His farm is 15 different backyards and rooftops in East Vancouver. So, you know, he's a real urban farmer. And I'll just tell you one story about his produce. We had signed up for his organic box program and, you know, a weekly box of organic food. And so I showed up to pick up the first box, and he's literally pulling the vegetables out of the ground. And he asks me if we'd like a head of iceberg lettuce. And I was actually kind of shocked, because iceberg lettuce is sort of the joke of the vegetable family. And, you know, if you go to a steakhouse and you order a salad, then they punish you by giving you an iceberg lettuce salad. I was actually just reading that if you own pet turtles, you're not supposed to feed them iceberg lettuce because it doesn't have enough nutrient content. You know, when he offered me this head of iceberg lettuce, I wondered what kind of half-assed farmer we'd signed up with, you know. And took the lettuce home and made a salad with it, and it was just a totally different experience. I mean, it was all that crispy, crunchy, white crinkliness that you expect from iceberg lettuce, but just full of flavor, and you could kind of feel the nutrients coming up in your body. So I think of it as Ward didn't just give us a head of iceberg lettuce that day. He changed the way we think about iceberg lettuce. And I think the City Farm Boy project is like that all the way through. I mean, Ward isn't just producing units of food in the city. He's changing the way we think about the city, how we see how we can use space in the city. He's even really, I think, he's creating a new way of life in the city. I mean, once you see a City Farm Boy in action, you start to ask yourself, well, you know, why don't we have a City Orchard Girl who harvests all the unused fruit in people's backyards, or a City Bee Boy who keeps hives on the top of 20 different apartment buildings and supplies a whole neighborhood with honey. So these are the sorts of projects that we're talking about. You know, small projects can contain really big ideas. I mean, that's sort of what the 100 Mile Diet was to begin with. But I guess we're not only going to be talking about small projects, because I think Elise is going to take us over to Ontario now. And I think sort of the subtitle of this is like Ontario's way better than Vancouver, nya, 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 something, something like that, right?
Yeah, Ontario is actually leading the way in a few local food fronts, which is quite amazing, because 5 years ago when we first went out there talking about local food and the 100 Mile Diet, Ontario was basically remedial when it came to local food. We'd talk about how great our farmers markets were, and they'd say, ours are horrible. I mean, you go there, people have driven up these trucks from California, they park them, they sell the stuff, they repackage it, they lie, they say it's local, and it's not. Just all kinds of things were going on there, and we were shocked. We could not believe that the whole farmers market principle of good food, good people was kind of didn't exist out there. We wondered what was wrong with them. But they shook their head and they realized, you know, this, we can't have this anymore. They got really into the local food movement and they made a lot of changes, and they made them really fast. I think it was almost because they were starting out with so little. They had no established patterns. They had no way of doing things. So they just moved quickly to get things going. So they started this whole new network of certified farmers markets so that you knew the produce was all produced within Ontario and sold directly from the farmer. That wasn't news to us, but Toronto got on board with that in 2007. But they went much further than that. At least 8 cities in Ontario have set very strict distance limits on how far the produce can come, 100 kilometers or less. Vancouver doesn't have any rules like that. The reason that they did it in Ontario is because they wanted to make sure that each of these regions where the farmers markets were, that the farmers weren't having to compete with other areas that already specialized in a product. They wanted to develop a really diverse agricultural base in each community, and that's a really good idea. And then another thing they did was at City Hall, putting their money where their budget dollars should be on local food. They actually decided, okay, we're going to set guaranteed percentages of how much local food that we're going to buy. Any service to do with City Hall, which would include daycares, seniors' homes, and shelters. In Ontario, or Toronto, sorry, that's a really big budget, about $11 million. So just since 2008, they've built up to 20% guaranteed of that budget going to local food. So that's about $2 million. That's a lot of cucumbers you'd be moving at a farmer's market to match that $2 million. So institutional buyers are very important. Right now, Vancouver has no set budget for its city services to be local food. And in Toronto, actually, their goal is 50%. Of course, that's still a bit of a dream, but it's a dream that's not just floating up there in the sky. They've actually hired a consultant to report back to City Hall by next year and tell them, you know, how much will it actually cost to do this 50% guaranteed local food, and then council will vote on it. It might not cost very much, actually, because in Toronto they did a small pilot project where they thought, okay, well, if we just increased the budget in our daycare services by 0.7%, less than 1%, but they managed to increase the local food from 20% to 33%. So just by spending $15,000 more, they got 13% more local food. So that's like a really exponential growth of their dollars when they spend it on local food like that. Other cities in Ontario are going even beyond just local. The city of Markham has decided to do both local and sustainable food. I'll talk about how they decide what's sustainable a bit later. So what they did, about 3 or 4 years ago, they thought, well, you know, we can't start big right away. But for the first year of all the city services to be spent on food, 10% of the budget, increased by 5% each year. So now they're at 25%. And the city of Hamilton is looking to start that same program. And when it comes to the campuses as well, the big university in Toronto, University of Toronto, their main campus has reached 20% guaranteed of their budget to local food. And at the U of T, that's $350,000, again, guaranteed to local growers. The University of British Columbia, they do buy some produce from the UBC farm each year, but that's only $3,000 worth of food, and they have no guaranteed percentages of their entire budget to be spent on local food. So in terms of deciding what is both local and sustainable food, we think that's a really great convergence. It's called Local Food Plus, and actually the president, I was talking to her, she was just out here for the last panel, so that's quite cool. And they are opening up some offices here in Vancouver in the near future and across Canada. And again, you know, this is an Ontario idea that's coming to us, because what they do is they gather up local farmers, and they don't just guarantee that the people are, you know, within the 100-mile circle kind of thing. They give them points in different areas of sustainability, and they have to reach a very high level of points in organic farming principles, farmland biodiversity, energy use on their farms, animal welfare standards, and labor standards. So they're putting all these things together. They certify the farmers. I think they have about 250 farmers in their network in Ontario. So what they can do then is when a big food contract, like for a university, comes up for renewal, they can tell these really big food suppliers like Sysco, things like that, you know, here we have the farmers ready, and they make a model that these really big food service suppliers can use, and if they convince the institution or a city to demand percentages of local food, these big companies will comply, and they have these pool of farmers at the ready. So that's a really great idea. So it's not just local, but it's sustainable, because we do often get that question when we speak places. It's like a catch-22. People seem to feel like, well, what would be better, local or organic? But we don't want people to have to make that choice. We want it to be both. In terms of just even businesses, I'd say one of the best local food stores I've ever seen anywhere was in Toronto. It's called Culinarium. And it's hard to explain what made it so special, but it's a sort of a combination of, it wasn't one-stop shopping for the local food movement, which isn't very common. It wasn't just the produce and the meat and the dairy, but they had dried beans, which are still hard to find. It's hard for vegetarians to do that, local food, if they can't get the beans. And they'd have kind of more unusual things like local popcorn, Ontario peanuts. We didn't even know peanuts grew in Ontario till we were at the store. And they would also sell things like pasta and tortillas with 100% local ingredients. So that makes local eating much easier for busy people. I'll be nice to Vancouver for a minute. I think it's very cool that in the last 2 years, we've allowed in the urban beehives and the backyard chickens. That's a huge thing in making urban land productive, making it farmland. Toronto hasn't quite met us on that front. Thank goodness, there's something they're worse at. They do allow beehives, but they have to be at least 30 meters from a property line. So for most people living in the heart of the city, you know, they don't have yards that big. They can't do it. But there is a beehive cooperative. They run hives out of the Dan Valley parklands and on rooftops downtown. So there is honey being made in the city. Chickens, though, still prohibited in Toronto. I was reading the list of prohibited animals. So chickens are on there with bears, gorillas, hyenas, and cotamundi, which I didn't even know what it was, but not allowed. So, James.
That was Alyssa Smith on Radio EcoShock. Now we go to James McKinnon, the other author of The 100-Mile Diet.
So I want to take you to another unexpected leader in local food, and this time I'm going to be talking about winter farming. The big guru of winter farming, he's been out here a couple of times, is a guy named Elliot Coleman, and he has a farm on the coast of Maine. So he gets serious winter weather, you know, pretty similar to Nova Scotia or Vancouver in late November. And one of Elliot's favorite sayings is that if you think that organic farming can't feed the world, then you haven't been paying attention. He gets away with saying things like that authoritatively because he produces $140,000 worth of food in a year off of a farm that's 1.5 acres in size. And he can do that in part because 40% of his production happens between October and May, so in the cold weather months. And this is not, we're not talking about greenhouses here. We're not, this isn't one of these situations where you get to eat a local tomato in January because 4 tons of coal have been burned to heat up a greenhouse. He uses just hoop houses. They're not heated at all. They're just, in fact, they're mobile, so he can move them from place to place. And I've had the good fortune to talk to Elliot a couple of times, and I asked him at one point why he thought winter farming hasn't taken off the way that it might. Maybe not surprisingly, he said it's because winter is really cold. Because of that, he always thought that the place that it would take off in first would be the Pacific Northwest and places like Vancouver, and that hasn't really been the case. The leader in cold weather farming, kind of the hot spot for cold weather farming, is Michigan, of all places. So we're talking about places like Ann Arbor and Detroit and Flint, which you might remember from the movie Roger and Me. These are places with serious winter. I mean, snow on the ground for 4 months of the year and temperatures that dip down to around minus 20 pretty often. So I had a chance to talk to a guy named John Birnbaum, who's he's a University of Michigan professor, and he's sort of the guy who's spearheading winter farming in Michigan. And he said there's a few reasons that it's working so well there. One is just the sheer desperation of Michigan. I mean, there's all these factory towns that are collapsing, and they're really just looking for anything that they can use to build up their economy. So that's part of it. And as a part of that, they've managed to get federal funding, so the government is actually buying hoop houses for farmers. But he said the main reason, the main challenge when it comes to winter farming isn't anything technical, it's cultural. He says that people just plain don't believe that you can eat locally in the winter, and that includes farmers. He takes people on hoop house tours, you know, through there, the hoop houses on the campus farm, and he shows people, you know, all these beautiful green luscious plants growing in the middle of winter, and he says people just plain don't believe him. He actually catches people sneaking away from the tour to go try and find where he's hiding the heater. They really just don't believe it. So, you know, his feeling is that the most important thing when it comes to things like winter farming or other, you know, really innovative new farming practices is to have incubator farms like the one, that's his term, incubator farms, like the one they have on that campus, which their campus farm produces food 48 weeks of the year and makes about 30% of its income in the winter months. And it has an 18-month waiting list for its organic box program. So it's a pretty big deal. A hoop house. It's basically a metal frame with a double-walled plastic covering, and it protects the plants from double wall plastic, just keeps the wind and the cold off the plants. And so he figures these incubator farms are the key, and that sort of every town and city of any size should have a teaching farm, an incubator farm. And of course, the good news here in Vancouver is that we do have the UBC farm, and there's, I believe, a teaching farm as part of the Garden City Lands proposal for Richmond. The bad news is that we don't really have the administrators and the sort of political people and the people with their hands on the levers of cash. We don't have those people as excited about the idea of farming as, you know, a really exciting intellectual opportunity. So one possible solution, I guess, is to buy those people tickets to Detroit in the winter. And with that, I think I'll leave it over to Lynn. Where are we going now? New York?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So because we've been spending the last few months in the Hudson Valley, I thought I'd talk about the amazing expansion of farmers markets in nearby New York City. But New York, 5 years ago, when we went out there to talk to publishers about the 100-mile diet, we actually had people in New York City say to us, you know, this whole local eating thing, impossible in New York. I mean, look around you, it's the concrete jungle. But since that time, it's totally changed. It would be very easy to eat within 100 miles of New York City today. So I'll do a comparison of our farmers market situation. Manhattan, although when you think of New York, you go, well, that's one of the world's biggest cities. So, of course, they have lots of farmers markets. But I'm just going to look at the urban core, Manhattan. That's just 1.6 million people. So that's the farmers market numbers I'm dealing with. Comparing to Vancouver, which our urban core is 600,000 people. In Manhattan, they've doubled the number of farmers markets since 2002. They have 27 different locations, up to 4 days a week. So in total, that gives you sort of 39 market shopping opportunities a week throughout the city. So that means there's one farmer's market per 41,000 people. In Vancouver, we have 4 markets, 1 day a week each, and that means there's one market per 150,000 people. In Manhattan, you can get to them walking distance in all neighborhoods. Just last Saturday, we went to 3 different ones, although we took subways between them because we wanted to kind of do the whole city. This one here is up as far north as you can go in Manhattan and not be in the river. 207th Street, a lot of the Dominicans live up in that neighborhood. And then we went to Midtown, Lincoln Plaza. And then the big one, Union Square, that one's the one that runs 4 days a week, even in the winter. That is an amazing market. And that's the one we went to 5 years ago when we were talking to publishers and said, you can't eat locally. We found things like these maps, and New York is one of the few places I've still seen that has these. Every single stall has a map saying, you know, where the farm is, just general little story about the farm, which is quite nice. Here's a close-up. So you can see exactly how far the farm is from New York City. That's very handy for shoppers because you don't have to keep asking questions. And we also found out that even though New York is such a large city, the median distance that the farmers are coming from is just 90 miles. And, of course, it's New York, so even the pet luxuries are local. And there's two really cool things that the Farmers Market Society there has been doing, because there's also a wheat revival in the American Northeast, just like there has been in BC the last few years. People seem really outraged when they find out that sort of the staff of life, that you can't get it grown where you live, so people really move on that. But what they've done in New York, the Green Market Society itself has been funding building mills so they can mill the flour locally more easily. And just this last year, they put in a rule that every baker selling at a farmer's market in New York City has to use at least 15% local flour in the bread. So that's a really great idea because they can create a market for this new industry. And as more flour gets produced, you know, hopefully it will become cheaper and the percentages will increase even more. And the other cool thing that they're doing, it's called the New Farmer Development Project. They focus on immigrant groups, mostly Spanish-speaking in New York, and they've been training them through Cornell University, 130 people since the year 2000. So they train them in farming techniques and business practices, but they also recognize that a lot of these countries, like the Dominican Republic, Mexico, they have their own small farmer traditions with a lot of knowledge that they can bring to the table as well. So when they're finished their training programs, they can start selling within their ethnic communities, and these are often in lower-income New York neighborhoods where they don't even have proper grocery stores. So that's a really important service. And they're also integrating into all the other community markets that already exist. There's one called Three Sisters, a Latino farm that we buy from in the little town near us called New Paltz.
So I want to start this next section with a personal story. A couple of years ago, friends of ours in Penticton invited us to raid a walnut tree that was on corporate land there in Penticton. And the tree was totally neglected, but we didn't really know what the laws were around raiding corporate nuts. So we ended up actually dressing all in black and going out at night with hockey sticks to knock the nuts down. You can picture the scene. It's sort of a low-budget Canadian horror film sort of thing. But we ended up with enough walnuts to supply, several households for a year. And that might be why I really like this little group in L.A. called they're called Fallen Fruit. And they believe that we really should be looking at how to have more free food in the city. And, fruit is the one that they focus on because it's kind of already out there. And Fallen Fruit's a bit of an unusual group for a local food group. It's founded by artists. It's still run by artists. And a lot of their projects have the feeling of art projects. So one of the things they did was sweep through different neighborhoods and pick all the fruit that was publicly available. And then they infused it in vodka. And the end result was that you had this ability to actually taste the difference in livability between different neighborhoods. So, if you went through a neighborhood, if it was a neighborhood that had all kinds of green space and public space, then it was going to be this delicious, rich, fruity vodka. And if it was one of these concrete and freeways type neighborhoods, then it's just, just a shot of straight rot gut. So it's, it has this sort of immediate, different way of looking at the city. Another thing they do is there's a number of groups that in different cities that pick fruit and give it to, the needy in one way or another. What they do is they give fruit trees to away in different neighborhoods. And they do this on an agreement. They give the tree, and the person who gets the tree agrees to plant it in such a way that some of the limbs will reach out over public land. Because in California, that's the rule. As soon as a limb reaches over public, crosses the private, public-private boundary, you can pick that fruit. So, and they're doing this in a big way. One day they gave out 450 trees, just one day. So that's enough to, that's at a scale that you can really start to see a change in the urban landscape. But the thing they're sort of best known for are maps. And they go out and they map the fruit resources in different neighborhoods. So this is a map of Larchmont, which is a neighborhood in L.A. It's a pretty well-to-do neighborhood and has a fair bit of fruit that you can reach from the street. And it's to be envied. You can't really see it here, but it's persimmons and passion fruit and lemons and limes and avocados and bananas. And, L.A. has a lot of people, as who are your genuinely hungry people. So one thing Fallen Fruit does is it leads foraging tours through neighborhoods like this one so that people can access the free food. Maps. This is Malmo in Sweden. This is interesting. You can see there's just an incredible abundance of fruit available. And it's because Sweden, Scandinavian countries have a very long tradition of fruit picking and wild berry foraging. And it's ended up kind of building itself into the cities themselves. And one thing I find interesting about this map is that it includes a lot of wild plants. So there's rose hips and wild apples and elderberry and things like this that in some places wouldn't even be recognized as food at all. But they make it onto the Malmo map. And that this is a neighborhood in Madrid. And you can see what happens when you have almost no public space. There's really no trees at all except in the plaza, which is the only publicly owned space in that neighborhood, and there's a good concentration of fruit there. So with these maps, Fallen Fruit helps people see, how different models of living in the city offer different elements of livability when it comes to things like fruit. And when I first bumped into Fallen Fruit, they talk about fruit and access to fruit in cities as a basic human right. And I thought that seemed a bit crazy, but then through these maps you see just how easy it is to make that possible and make it accessible, and then it becomes a pretty exciting idea.
That is part one of a talk by Alyssa Smith and James McKinnon, authors of The 100-Mile Diet. We are hearing their top 10 food localization projects 5 years after the start of the movement. Is your city able to feed itself at all? Do you want to know who grew your food? Stay tuned for part two as Alyssa and James continue this underreported story of growing sanity.
This is Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex. We'll continue now with our tour of 10 local food hotspots with James McKinnon and Alyssa Smith, authors of The 100 Mile Diet. This recording is courtesy of the Tides Foundation, Tai-E Magazine, and the Museum of Vancouver, recorded November 25th. Alyssa picks up with their observations from the months the couple spent in northern Spain. They stayed in a tiny village to learn about local food.
So a lot of people have an image of Europe as a local food paradise full of all kinds of traditional delicacies. I had that image. I certainly must admit that. But this summer, we spent 4 months in Spain, and we got up close and personal with a very traditional village in northern Spain. So I can kind of tell you, at least in that part of the world, what is true, what we can learn from them, but also that they have things that they can learn from us. And there's a lot of romanticizing that goes on when it comes to what they eat in Europe. This is the village that we stayed in for the summer, called Villanueva. There's probably only about 40 people live there, so we were a bit of an oddity when we arrived. But it's in the north of Spain. It's very much cooler than the rest of the country, mountainous, green, rainy. So in a way, it's hotter, but the climate's kind of like Vancouver. But here, the church is 900 years old, a bit older than the buildings in Vancouver, I've heard. And also, even older than that church, was their tradition of raising beef cattle. It was always a nomadic kind of thing, but what's cool, even in the modern day, it still is nomadic. Most people just keep a handful of cows, which I think is quite cool because in Europe, you're a farmer if you've got four cows. You know, here people seem to think you're a hobby farmer if you had four cows, but they recognize there that it's still a lot of work, any kind of farming that you do, and it's integrated into their lives, and they take care of these cows every day. Because what they do there is sort of through the spring, winter, and fall, every day they take them from the barn near their house and they put them in a little pasture nearby. And then during the midsummer, they cut the hay by hand, still a lot of people in this village, and they stack it up to dry. And they just leave it outside for the winter. They pile it up a bit higher than that around these poles. And then the cows, though, meanwhile, have been up in the mountains for the summer. So they go everywhere that you see in this slide, even these really steep mountain sides. They're very adventurous, truly free range. And those little stone structures at the bottom there, that's called brañas. Up till about 40 years ago, that was the summer village. Everyone in the village we lived in went up the mountain with their cows. The cows still do go up the mountain. They walk them up that road from our village. It's about 4 kilometers. And then they come up and check on them all the time. This is one of the summer houses, and they just build them out of what is at hand. It is quite warm in the summer, so they just heap up some stones, put some gorse that's just growing around the house on the roof. And this is one of the high mountain pasture areas. So it's just tradition. Each village has a specific area on each of these mountains. Like back there, there's cows on that mountain as well from a different village. It's just protected now by what they call a natural park status. So they allow these traditional uses of the land, but it can't be developed at all. And this is one of the Asturian red cows. They are fearsome beasts, actually. So when we were hiking up there, I was pretty nervous of these cows, wondering, you know, are they going to charge? They've got their horns. You know, we don't have the horns left on the cows here anymore. Asked the locals if they were safe, and he said, oh, yeah, I mean, they're safe, except, you know, whenever they get out of hand, people deal with it. So they do go crazy sometimes. So it took me a while to get used to them, but we did go hiking amongst the cows. And then another tradition that they have in Europe that really helps protect local food is called the denomination of origin. So the government actually puts rules in place protecting both the ancient ways that foods are made and the ingredients they're made with. In Asturias, their most famous product is an apple cider alcohol. So it's very popular with people to try it out. It's very dry, made of heritage apples. And what you're supposed to do is traditionally they want it all frothed up. It's flat in the bottle. So you pour it from as high as you possibly can. But the truly traditional way of doing it, the very good bartenders, they can hold the bottle up here and the glass down here and not look at either and not spill anything. But however you choose to drink it, I mean, because it's protected by a denomination of origin, that gives it a kind of cachet. And every tourist or even people from other parts of Spain come to Asturias, they try the cider. And the other thing that they used to do is, this is just right outside the house we were, a little primitive as you can see, but that's not a house, that's a food storage house made of wood. They protect their food in the winter months when it's rainy. And that whole hillside behind it, that was the food. All those are chestnut trees. Again, traditionally, each family in the village had an area on the hillside that were their trees. They didn't own them, but just everyone knew who went where. They'd pick the chestnuts, store them in the house, and the other thing they'd store would be spelt and other fruits. Basically, that whole landscape has been remade into their garden. If it's not a chestnut tree, it's an apple or a cherry or a plum. So they'd be storing all those foods. But unfortunately today, that's one of the things that's not protected by the denomination system, the chestnuts. So all that forest just falling to the ground, people aren't picking the chestnuts anymore. So that's kind of what we realized when we were over there, that they do have a lot of these old traditions, but they're not being incorporated into the modern food system as people there get old who have the skills. So all of these cows that we saw around us, somewhere somebody was eating them, but we don't know who. We could not buy that meat in the grocery stores near us. We'd see all these little gardens with tomato, kales, onions near us, couldn't buy that stuff in the store. Backyard chickens near us, couldn't buy those eggs. So that's a real problem over there. If they're going to the supermarket, even if they buy the beans to make their traditional bean dish, which is the signature of the area, called fabada asturiana, those beans are from Bolivia now. So in actual fact, with the exception of some of these exceptional denomination of origin foods, like there's cave cheeses or, you know, things like ham that has to be aged for 4 years and the pigs have to have eaten acorns in a forest. You know, it's very particular. Besides that, we actually realized when you go to a farmer's market, what we get in Vancouver, the produce is actually much tastier than anything we bought at any Spanish farmer's market. So we're actually very lucky here. We have a tradition of lots of organic farms, small-scale farms, and I think really good soil here. So we should really cherish the quality of the food we get here.
There's a book that recently came out called Empires of Food, and it looks at different societies that have had their food systems fail entirely. And the main researcher for that book is a Canadian guy named Evan Fraser. And I was talking to him about it, and he said that in the end he concluded that the strongest food system that's possible, really, is much like what Elisa was just showing in Asturias. And that is a system where they specialize in whatever the landscape is the very best suited to do, so in that case, the Asturian cattle, but there's also a great deal of other crop diversity. So in the case of Asturias, the spelt, the chestnuts, all the fruit trees, all of the small garden produce. And he calls it embedded diversity, so a diversity of crops embedded in a landscape that is also specialized to produce the things that it is very best suited to produce. The problem with most food systems today is that, you know, we're very good at the specialization part now, much, much poorer at maintaining the diversity part. For example, we all enjoy Okanagan wines, I think, but because of that, the Okanagan is slowly turning into one big vineyard. So they've been losing their grasslands, they're losing their heritage orchards. Real estate is really, you know, in many cases priced out of reach for anybody, any kind of farmer except grape farmers. The end point of that process is the Napa Valley in California. In 1968, grapes accounted for 26% of the agricultural production in Napa Valley. Last year, it was 99%. So they've started to look at it and say, well, is this a sustainable food system? And I mean, I've gone a couple weekends where I've had nothing but Cabernet, but you don't want to do that as a year-long diet, I don't think. So they're actively trying to reverse that now. And one of the groups they're working with on that is a nonprofit called California Farm Link. And they do a number of different things. One of the things that they're sort of most successful with is it's like an online dating service to link people who want to be farmers to the little patches of land where they might be able to farm. And I looked at it recently, and there was 160 different farming opportunities in California, none of which involved the purchase of land. So in each of these cases, it was crop sharing or leasing or partnerships, in some cases with vineyards. You know, some of the vineyards are inviting people to plant crops for example, in bottomlands where grapes don't grow so well. So what, that's one thing they're doing. Another thing they're working on is, or have actually won, is a program to offer small, low-interest loans to people who want to start farms. And unfortunately, I mean, the great thing about it is that they have this program. They've won it. They got it from the government. The bad thing is that the government has approved the program, but no money for the program. So it's one of these things that exists on paper but has no money to support it. It's like the American economy itself in that way. They're fighting now to get that funding, and it looks good for them soon. The third thing they're doing that I think is interesting is they're linking older farmers to younger farmers. So in California right now, farmers who are older than 60 years outnumber farmers younger than 25, 60-1. So you can see there's a potential problem there. And what's typically been happening is that farmers reach retirement age and they stop farming. Their farms fall into disuse and eventually they have to be sold for development because they can't keep up with taxes and so on. FarmLink is finding young farmers, connecting them to these farmers as they approach their retirement, and getting them on, getting the younger farmers onto that land and farming the land before they're even close to being able to actually purchase the land, which is, of course, incredibly expensive. But the big thing that comes out if you talk to people in Napa is don't turn into Napa. You know, they just say, do not let your food system get to this level of specialization. So a strong local food system, it's not just about, you know, building new traditions or even sort of tapping into old ones. It can also just be about hanging on to what we have. And, you know, Vancouver has, lucky enough to have, quite a diverse food system still. So that should be part of our job here.
This is my last point. When me and James did the 100-mile diet, sort of after we'd settled into our new patterns and gotten over the initial trauma of not being able to find things, we're like, if we're actually doing pretty good here, really the only thing we're missing is olive oil. If only someone could ship it up by sailboat from California, totally ecological, we'd be so happy. And we thought it was kind of a joke or a dream or something, but now it's actually happening. There's a company in France that started shipping wine by sailboat to the UK, and now they've made two trips to Montreal. So it's happening. I don't know. We're going to have to get that wine on the train or something to get it over here. But what's happening down with the group Sustainable Ballard is a different version of sail freight as well. Ballard is kind of a suburb of Seattle. It's really attached to Seattle. But they have the same problem Vancouver has there. There's lots of people who would like to buy organic food, but, you know, with urban sprawl, there's a shortage of farmland, land's very expensive. So they thought to themselves, why don't we start a cooperative and sail up to the Olympic Peninsula every 2 weeks, which is what they did all spring through fall. They did their last trip last week. They're probably glad they're not going this week. They went and got organic vegetables. And this is a perfect match, really, because the Olympic Peninsula is, by modern standards, the total boonies. They have nowhere to sell their organic produce to in their area. So instead of driving it all the way to Seattle, they're picking it up by sailboat. So they reported on Twitter their parts of their voyage. It takes about 12 hours, kind of depending on the wind. But you feel like you're there with them. It's quite neat. So they talk about how their last trip, their departure was postponed until 7:30 because they had to wait for low tide and then they could just barely get their mast under the bridge. And then another trip, they had to row out of Squim Bay because there was no wind. And then they saw a sea lion and raced a ferry as the wind picked up to 5 knots and they won. And they are very excited when they report back. We see Seattle and you kind of imagine the skyline. And then they report, Ballard, your sailors and organic veggies are safely home. So you feel like you were kind of there with them. And then what happens, they pick it up by bicycle, the people who subscribed, after it has been brought to them by electric car from the docks. It's got it all. So I thought, you know, this would be a really good thing to do in the Gulf Islands. Because right now, Salt Spring is doing pretty well for itself. It's got a lot of farmers there. People support the farmers market. But on some of the smaller islands like Maine and Pender, land is still very expensive there, but there's not really a big enough population to support their farming. But Tsawwassen is only 26 kilometers away by boat from Maine Island. And that would be a really good way of reviving small-scale farming in the Gulf Islands and increasing the farmland that's available to Vancouver as well. It's not just coastal sail freight. Actually, one of the most inspiring ones that I heard about, it was one of the earliest ones, maybe 3 years ago, in the Kootenays. And there's a lot of communities on the Kootenay Lake. It's huge. They decided that they wanted to start growing local grain. They got excited by that idea. But because there's so many ecologically minded people there, the farmers on the lake said, okay, we're going to use horses instead of tractors to keep fossil fuel out of the equation. And then the local sailing club said, hey, let's carry that a step further. We'll deliver the grain so that there's no fossil fuel whatever in the system. So there's all these communities on the edge of Kootenai Lake that are extremely remote. Before, they had no one to sell to, really. But now they can sell to Nelson. So the first year of the project, they had 3 boats delivering the grain. And then the next year, they had 11 boats because they had so much more grain. They'd increased their subscription to 600 people and 100 pounds of grain for each person. And there's one final frontier in sail freight that I'm very excited about. It's not just olive oil. I lied that I wished I could have had when I did the 100-mile diet, 100%. Chocolate. In Brooklyn, New York, there is an artisan chocolate company called the Mast Brothers, and that's their real name. Maybe it inspired them to do sail freight. They have a boat lined up, the Black Seal. It's a 3-masted 70-foot schooner, and they're making a trip to the Dominican Republic in May and picking up 20 tons of cocoa beans. So I think, I don't know, me and James might have to move within 100 miles of Brooklyn.
So this is my last journey with us tonight, I guess. And for me, it's kind of maybe the most important, too, and that's the idea of linking local food to ecological restoration, which is another big area of interest for me. And this brings us full circle back to the Vancouver area as well. And the food I want to talk about is a food called the Wapato. Some of you might have read about it in the Eat Your History series that I guest edited for the Taiyi. And the Wapato, I mean, prior to European settlement in this area, of course, there was no wheat, there was no rice, there was no potatoes. The main complex carbohydrate source was this aquatic tuber called the Wapato that grew in wetlands and riverbanks. This was not some minor food source. I mean, there was a study done in the Columbia River, which was also a Wapato area, and they found the waters just around one island in the Columbia produced enough Wapato to feed 31,000 people for a year. So this was a major food source, and it was also, really a major part of our cultural history. People ate Wapato in this area for more than 4,500 years, and then in the last 100 years or so, it's mainly been forgotten. So this woman named Roma Leon decided she wanted to revive the Wapato, and I was lucky enough to go along with a Taiyi reporter named Joanne Will, and we went out on the harvest. So this is Mike Leon and Roma Leon. Mike's the chief of the Katsi First Nation, and Roma's a member of the Katsi as well, and they were traditionally sort of big Wapato culture in this area. And as you can see from the jackets and the blankets and so on, it's a pretty cold day because Wapato harvest season is right about now. And that's a little bit of a disadvantage because of this. To harvest the Wapato, you jump in the river. And I had my wetsuit with me, and I was wondering when Roma was going to change into whatever she wears into the river. And then, boom, she's off the boat in her jeans and socks. And so nothing to do but follow her. Traditionally, Wapato harvesting was only done by women. I thought that tradition would probably have gone by the wayside, but then I asked Mike when he was coming in, and he just was like, no way am I going to do this. So what you do to get the Wapato is you loosen up the mud with these sticks that we're holding, and then you just kind of, it's like you're stomping grapes. It's like you're a Stairmaster, only while somebody pours jugs of ice water down your pants. So you do this, and you break up the roots, and the Wapato float to the surface. I actually got quite into it after a while, churning away there. And the interesting thing is that Wapato is a plant that actually benefits from being eaten. So what you're doing when you do this traditional harvesting is you're not only bringing up the Wapato, but you break up the roots, and chunks of root float down the river, and they start new Wapato patches. And Wapato right now are fairly rare. I mean, it used to be very, very common and abundant, but fairly rare now because people, partly because we've been channelizing the river and draining wetlands and so on, but also because we stopped eating the Wapato. So we actually have this opportunity where if we were able to revive the Wapato, we'd also be restoring the historical ecology of this area. And not only the Wapato would be restored, and it is, by the way, a beautiful white flower in the spring before it dies off and becomes the tuber, But not just the Wapato would benefit, but there was a lot of things that ate Wapato. The Fraser Valley used to be a major, major area for canvasback duck abundance because they love the Wapato. So were we to start eating them again, we'd be benefiting at least those two species. So this is the first Wapato that floated up, and we were so excited when this thing came up to the surface. And then Roma waded over and said the reason it came up so quickly is because it was rotten. And this is our harvest. So I put this in here mainly to show the frost. This is how cold it was. This was our little Wapato harvest. It was just an experiment to see what might be out there, and that's what we found. And we took them home, and we cooked them up, baked them. They bake up about the same speed as a baked potato. And they taste kind of like potato, but sweeter, more like they've got a little corn or chestnut or something in there. You know, a wonderful food, and really no reason that it should have disappeared from our radar. But the thing I want to leave you with, I guess, is when we got those home, they were covered in river mud. And I was washing the mud off, and I was like, wow, these things smell funky. Like, they smell like sewer. This was a strangely poignant moment for me. You know, I think for me, through this whole process of local eating, the thing that's always been most impact, or had the most impact, is what I learn by connecting with where my food is coming from. And in this case, what I learned was we're not treating that river very well. And it was amazing. I mean, that one day waiting around after Wapato really told me more about the Fraser River and what we're doing to it and how we might change that than reading 50 newspaper articles could ever do. So I thank Roma, I thank the Wapato, and I think Elise is going to take us out of here.
I mean, Vancouver has made amazing advances in local food in the last 5 years. I think if we were to try the 100-mile diet today, it would not be nearly so much of a challenge, because when we did it, there were no farmers markets all the way from October through June. Those were long months for us. And we couldn't find wheat for very many months, and that's just to supply two people. We had to make our own bread once we did find it, and we even had to make our own salt to go in the bread. Local seafood was, besides salmon, totally a mystery what was out there till a local fisherman, Steve Johansson, introduced us to the spot prawn. He didn't just introduce us to it, though. He introduced all the chefs in the city to the spot prawn, and now every year there is a spot prawn festival. That's how much more popular it's gotten. Now there is a winter farmers market every week, and we had to wait like 7 months between in the winter. And now you can keep beehives and chickens in the city. And just that alone, I mean, I looked up how much honey can you get from one hive, 100 pounds from one hive. I only use about 12 pounds of honey in a year myself. One heritage Chanticleer chicken lays about 200 eggs a year. You're allowed to keep four in any yard in Vancouver. So that's 800 eggs a year. I think that'll do for me and James. And then all we need is a yard to go along with it. We couldn't find wheat. We were on an involuntary Atkins diet, but now there's an urban grain cooperative. It supplies 225 people and 75 bakeries and restaurants. There's people selling 100-mile bread at the farmer's market now. There's a guy making 100-mile salt, the Vancouver Island Salt Company. There's even a wheat festival in Victoria. It's even possible to be 100-mile vegan now. There's a dried bean cooperative, so you can do it all now. And so I guess I just want to leave you with all that innovation and participation in food culture, really, because all of us are part of it by growing things, by buying things from our local farmers. So let's keep on innovating, and we can make Toronto eat dirt and local dirt. Thank you very much.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. That was James McKinnon and Alyssa Smith. Their book, The 100-Mile Diet, has set off a cascade of efforts in North America and beyond to support the production of local food. It helps save the atmosphere, makes your city more secure, and gives you more nutritious organic food. Please pass this Radio EcoShock special on to your friends, coworkers, and local government. We can do it and survive. You can download this program as a free MP3 from the food page at ecoshock.org. I recorded this talk at the Museum of Vancouver on November 25, 2010. My thanks to the speakers, the museum, Tai Magazine, and the Tides Foundation for this really worthwhile presentation. Find those links in my blog for this program at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our future together.
Yeah, that was the thing that surprised us when we started speaking in different communities about local food. We found that the local economy angle is actually what gets a lot of people on board with it, people who wouldn't otherwise consider themselves left-wing or progressive, even though the local economic angle of it is as political as anything. But definitely, I mean, we're basically remaking the economic system if we return to true local economies. It actually creates more jobs, keeps more money in the community. So we've had nothing but support wherever we go. Even the American Midwest has actually been one of the more supportive places of it, which you would not think. You know, if you follow American election coverage, they're like, oh, you know, the dreaded Republican middle kind of thing. But they're totally interested in the economics of the local.
It also had that it's politically interesting at a global level as well. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, one of the arguments that's often made around local food is that by eating locally, we're somehow, you know, dreadfully undermining the economies of people in sort of distant places in the globe, which, you know, frankly, is a brand new concern for global capitalism. But there's a wonderful book. I mean, I won't claim to be an expert in this stuff, but I will recommend a book by Raj Patel called Stuffed and Starved. And Raj is a great guy. I mean, he studied global food systems and, you know, globalization. And at the end of it, he now calls himself a locavore. And the principle is pretty simple: is that strong local food systems first and foremost should be the rule. And it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter if you're here. It doesn't, you know, Indonesia, South Africa, the Dominican Republic, wherever. Strong local food systems, that's the first priority. Makes tremendous sense. And we've spent the last 100 years really slowly undermining local food systems throughout the globe, you know, through this process of globalization. And so it isn't just a question of, you know, relocalizing here that in this place we think of as home, but also in all of these other places that have, you know, been supplying our food for the last 50 years.
This is Radio EcoShock going out with Dan Mangan, and he's been sold.
Suits have come for me. Found alternatives to honesty. Body and soul were bought and sold. Patented and out of reach, so I reach. But it hurts, it kills, it screams, and it fills my heart with chills. And I take my pills, but I'm still tired of sleeping with the light on. It keeps the hair out of my eyes. Back it up and send it home. For just one stab at the good life, that's enough. And I'm so gave up all my wretched thoughts and left them out for the less fortunate. Now at the gate I'll skip the queue. Life's not living unless you're sure to make it through. But now it hurts, it kills, it screams, and it fills my heart with chills. And I take my pills, but I'm still sleeping with the light on. Oh. But if it keeps the hair out of my eyes, pack it up and send it home. For just one stab at the good life, that's enough. And I'm